1.1 FM and on the web at weft.org.
Support for WEFT programming is made possible in part by New Prairie Solar, a division of New Prairie Construction Company in Urbana, Illinois. New Prairie Solar offers custom solar systems and solutions for reducing electricity costs. Consultations are available by calling 217-344-5131. For more information, newprairiesolar.com.
And again, we thank all of our listeners, donors, contributors, community partners that helped keep WEFT viable and on the air.
If you have a passion for bluegrass, local music, or reggae, then you are in luck because you are tuned to 90.1 FM WEFT. Our programming is created by our volunteer staff. At WEFT, it is elected committee members, enthusiastic air shifters, and dedicated members who decide what is unique and important to hear on the radio. WEFT is home to a wealth of knowledgeable hosts who bring you fascinating programs each week. Whether you're into gospel or jazz, Celtic jigs or Delta blues, salsa or hip-hop, we've got a show for you. If you have a passion for unique music and information, show it and help us continue to provide this service to you. Please go to weft.org and click on the Support WEFT link.
This is a pre-recorded program from September 23rd, 2024.
This is Disability Beat, a public affairs program for and about people with disabilities. It's about social justice, community supports, inclusion, accessibility, freedom, and choice. My name is Vicki Nicewander, and I'm the host of this program and also the parent of a fantastic young woman with a disability.
The views and opinions expressed here are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT, its board of directors, associate station manager, or Prairie Air Incorporated.
Stay tuned for a pre-recorded short lecture by Judith Heumann, a disability rights advocate known as the mother of the disability rights movement, who unfortunately passed away a year ago in March 2023. But first, disability news for the week of September 23rd, 2024. Students with disabilities frequently use smartphones, tablets, and smartwatches to help them with communication and note-taking, among other functions, under the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act and Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act. Students with disabilities have the right to utilize that technology to assist them. But according to the Council of Parent Attorneys and Advocates, or COPE, a nonprofit that advocates for the rights of students with disabilities and their families, COPE is warning that these rights are at risk if policymakers implement restrictions on the use of devices at school. The concerns have merit as restrictions on cell phones and other devices in schools are growing across the country. 7 states have already approved policies banning or limiting cell phone use in schools, and 14 other states are considering similar legislation, according to a report issued this month by KFF, a nonprofit that conducts health policy research. According to Denise Marshall, CEO of COPE, quote, "As many of these bills or policies are new and are not yet in effect, we are trying to make a preemptive statement that encourages taking a good look at the policies to be sure that they are not going to result in the unintended consequence of limiting access to assistive technology," end quote. Even before this wave of restrictions, assistive technology has been underutilized to assist students with disabilities. Earlier this year, the U.S. Department of Education issued guidance reminding schools of their obligation to frequently consider the need for assistive technology for a student with a disability. COPE has said that parents should not have to be responsible to ensure that assistive technology noted in their child's IEP or 504 plan comply with new laws or policies. The group does not want parents to be responsible with assuring that their children receive the accommodations they need despite new rules. Copay also notes that students with disabilities should not be segregated from their non-disabled classmates because their use of devices differs from rules in place for other students. Dan Stewart, managing attorney for education and employment at the National Disability Rights Network, said he is not aware of any legal claims regarding assistive technology use under the new school device restrictions yet, but he's concerned. Stewart said, quote, bans effectively remove the students' legal entitlements to those disability-related needs. Further, if a school has a ban, the school's IEP or the student's IEP or Section 504 team would not be able to consider, include, or implement those low-cost and effective strategies into a student's plan or in a revised plan. In other words, the ban stops an IEP team or 504 team from considering a full range of options to support a student with a disability, end quote. Stewart also noted, however, that, quote, if a student with a disability is able to actually use a phone or AI device even when there is a ban and other students are unable to use them because of the ban, the student with a disability may feel ashamed, singled out, harassed, or otherwise because of using it or reluctant to use the phone or AT device. This dynamic could also reduce a student's use of the phone or AT device, which is specifically included as a tool for the student to succeed, end quote. Researchers looked at 842 children and young adults with Down syndrome recently who visited the Boston Children's Hospital Down Syndrome Program between March of 2018 and March of 2023 to evaluate how they track developmentally. The findings from Harvard University were published online earlier this month in the journal Pediatrics. Those findings show prominent differences between children with Down syndrome as compared to their typically developing peers, which will not surprise any parent of a person with Down syndrome. For example, most kids with Down syndrome can walk independently in their home by age 4 and a half, follow one-step directions by age 5 and a half, run and use stairs by around age 8, and drink from an open cup by about 12. By the time they are teens, at least 75% of children with Down syndrome follow two-step directions or use at least 50 words, signs, or pictures. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says that most children develop all of those skills by the age of about 2 and a half. Dr. Nicole Balmer and her colleagues from Harvard University wrote in the paper, "The American Academy of Pediatrics recommends that children and adolescents with Down syndrome, quote, receive anticipatory guidance regarding development and behavior. However, few tools provide specific guidance on developmental norms for children with Down syndrome. Our objective was to estimate age ranges at which children and adolescents with Down syndrome achieve developmental milestones to facilitate developmental screening by pediatric practitioners," end quote. Dr. Marilyn Bull of the Indiana University School of Medicine said the findings will help clinicians determine if developmental delays are typical or worth further evaluation. Bull wrote, quote, "Currently, developmental assessment is based predominantly on clinical expertise, but now clinicians will be able to systematically assess development in several domains at routine health supervision visits. These data illustrate that achievement of skills is spread over a wide age span in persons with Down syndrome than neurotypical children, and that it can be used by clinicians to effectively evaluate developmental progress." And finally, earlier this month, Judge Sharon Johnson Coleman with the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of Illinois denied a request by the state of Illinois to end court oversight of its disability services. The ruling first happened in 2011 with a settlement resulting from a lawsuit accusing the state of failing to provide supports for people who wanted to live in the community. The Ligas consent decree forced the state to provide increased funds into the disability services system. In her ruling, Judge Coleman acknowledged that while the state has made significant progress since 2011 in expanding community-based services, it has not fully met the mandates of the consent decree. Her one-page decision denying the state's request to end oversight did not provide specific opinions on recent issues like abuses in state-operated developmental centers, but said they will remain the focus of future proceedings. And that's the news for this week. And you are listening to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. This is Disability Beat. I'm Vicki Nicewander, and today we'll be listening to a lecture by one of the most important disability advocates that ever lived in recent years. After contracting polio, before she turned 2 years old, Judy Heumann used a wheelchair for most of her life. She and her family fought to be included in the public schools. For years, every summer, she attended Camp Jened, a camp for children with disabilities in New York, where she learned about the life experiences that she shared with other children with disabilities who ultimately all became very important advocates in our world. A recent documentary called Crip Camp features a young Judy Heumann as well as other important disability advocates. After many years as an advocate, Heumann served as Assistant Secretary of the Office of Special Education and Disability Services in the Clinton administration and was later appointed by President Obama as a Special Advisor on International Disability Rights for the U.S. State Department. Here is Judith Heumann.
I was born in 1947, a long time ago. And when I was 18 months old, I had polio. I was in an iron lung for 3 months and in and out of the hospital for 3 years. Now, we had lots of neighbors in our Brooklyn neighborhood, and some of them were really very helpful for my parents. Some of them were really afraid of contagion, and they wouldn't even walk in front of our house. They would literally walk across the street. I think this was a time when my family really began to realize what disability meant to some people, fear. And it wasn't even a sure thing that I would live at home, although I didn't learn about this till I was 36 years old. I was having a discussion with my father one night, and he said, you know, when you were 2 years old, one of the doctors suggested to your mom and I that you live in an institution, that they could just go ahead with their lives and raise their kids and kind of be done with having to deal with all the disability-related things. I didn't believe my father, not because he was a liar, but I had never heard this story. And my mother, in fact, validated that. She never wanted to tell me. But in reality, I don't know why I was really surprised by this story. Because when I was 5 years old, and my mother, like mothers and fathers all across the United States, was taking me to school to enroll. She pushed my wheelchair to the school in walking distance to our house, pulled the wheelchair up the steps into the school, and we were greeted by the principal, not really greeted, but the principal said, no, I couldn't come to that school because it wasn't accessible. But he told us not to worry, because the Board of Education, in fact, would send a teacher to my house. And they did, for a total of 2.5 hours a week. But for good behavior, they threw in an occupational therapist who taught me that very essential skill of cross-stitching. I don't cross-stitch today. I didn't actually get to go to school in a real building until I was 9 years old. And then I was in classes only with disabled children in a school that had mainly non-disabled children. And in my classes, there were students up to the age of 21. And then after 21, they went to something called sheltered workshops with menial work and earning either nothing or below minimum wage. So I understood discrimination. My parents understood discrimination. My parents came from Germany. They were German Jews who left in the 1930s, escaping the Holocaust. My parents lost family and they lost parents. Both my parents lost their parents in the Holocaust. And so they realized that they could not be silent as things were going wrong for me in my life. Not me personally, but what was going on around me. They learned that because I used a wheelchair, none of the high schools in New York City and the entire city were wheelchair accessible. So what was supposed to happen is I was supposed to go back onto home instruction along with many other students. So my parents banded together with other parents. They went to the Board of Education and they demanded that the Board of Ed make some of the high schools accessible. And they did. And so I and many others were finally able to go to high school, a regular high school, and take regular classes. So what happened next? I was learning more and more about what discrimination was, and equally important, I was learning that I needed to become my own advocate. I was entering college, Long Island University, and I had always wanted to be a teacher. And so I minored in education, and I took all the appropriate courses. And then when it was time for me to go for my license, I had to take a written exam, an oral exam, and a medical exam. At that time, all three of those exams were given in completely inaccessible buildings. So I had friends who carried me up and down the steps for these exams, not in a motorized wheelchair. In a manual wheelchair. But I passed my oral exam. I passed my written exam. My medical exam was something completely different. One of the first questions the doctor asked me was, could I please show her how I went to the bathroom? I was 22 years old. And you know, when you go for any kind of an interview, you think about all the kinds of questions people could ask you. That was not one of them. And I was like freaked out in the first place because I had heard that there were actually no disabled people using wheelchairs who were teachers in New York. So each step along the way, I was expecting something bad. So I said to her, is it a requirement that teachers show their students how to go to the bathroom? If it is, I can do that. So, no surprise, I was failed because I didn't pass the medical. The official reason that I was denied my job was paralysis of poliomyelitis, sequelae of paralysis of both lower limbs, sequelae of poliomyelitis. Honestly, I didn't know what the word sequelae meant, so I went to the dictionary and it meant because of. So I'd been denied my license because I couldn't walk. So what was I going to do? This is a really important time in my life because it would be the first time that I really would be challenging the system, me. And although I was working with a lot of other friends who had disabilities who were encouraging me to move forward with this, it was nonetheless quite frightening. But I was really very lucky. I had a friend who was a disabled student at Long Island University and was also a stringer at the New York Times. And he was able to get a reporter to write a really good piece about what had happened and why he thought what had happened was wrong. The next day, there was an editorial in the New York Times with the title of Human versus the Board of Education. And the New York Times came out in support of my getting my teaching license. And then the same day, I got a call from an attorney who was writing a book about civil rights. And he was calling me to interview me, and I was interviewing him. He didn't know that. And at the end of our discussion, I said, would you be willing to represent me? I want to sue the Board of Education. And he said, yes. Now, sometimes I say that the stars were aligned around this court case, because we had an amazing judge. The first African-American female federal judge, Constance Baker Motley. And she knew discrimination when she saw it. So she strongly encouraged the Board of Ed to give me another medical exam, which they did. And then I got my license. And while it took a number of months for me to actually get a principal to offer me a job, I finally did get a job, and I started teaching that fall in the same school that I had gone to second grade. So that's a whole other TED talk. But I was learning, as my friends were, and people I didn't know around the country, that we had to be our own advocates, that we needed to fight back people's view that if you had a disability, you needed to be cured, that equality was not part of the equation. And we were learning from the civil rights movement and from the women's rights movement. We were learning from them about their activism and their ability to come together, not only to discuss problems, but to discuss solutions. And what was born is what we call today the disability rights movement. So I'd like to tell you a couple of riddles. How many people do you think it takes to stop traffic on Madison Avenue during rush hour in New York City? Have a guess? How many? 50. One would be too little. 50 people. And there were no accessible paddy wagons, so they had to just kind of deal with us. But let me tell you another riddle. How many people does it take to stop a bus in New York City when they refuse to let you on because you're in a wheelchair? One. That is the right answer. So what you have to do, though, is take your wheelchair, sidle in the right place, right in front of the steps, and give it a little push underneath, and then their bus can't move. Any of you who want to learn how to do that, talk to me after this. In 1972, President Nixon vetoed the Rehabilitation Act. We protested, he signed it. Then the regulations that needed to be promulgated to implement that law had not in fact been signed. We demonstrated, they were signed. And when the Americans with Disabilities Act, the ADA, our Emancipation Proclamation Act, looked as though it might not in fact be passed in the House or Senate, disabled people from all across the United States came together and they crawled up the Capitol steps. That was an amazing day. And the House and Senate passed the ADA. And then President Bush signed the ADA. It's a great picture. President Bush signed the ADA on the lawn of the White House. It was an amazing day. And there were about 2,000 people there. It was July 26, 1990. And one of the most famous statements he had in his speech was, "Let the shameful walls of exclusion finally come tumbling down." For any of you in the room who are 50 or older, or maybe even 40 or older, you remember a time when there were no ramps on the streets, when buses were not accessible, when trains were not accessible, where there were no wheelchair accessible bathrooms and shopping malls, where you certainly did not have a sign language interpreter or captioning or braille or other kinds of supports. These things have changed, and they have inspired the world. And disabled people around the world want laws like we have, and they want those laws enforced. And so what we've seen is something called the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. It is a treaty that was adopted in 2006. It's celebrating its 10th year anniversary. More than 165 countries have joined this treaty. It is the first international human rights treaty fully focused on disabled people. But I am sad to say that our U.S. Senate has failed to recommend to our president that we ratify the treaty. We signed it in 2009, but it doesn't come into force until ratification. And the president, no president, can ratify a treaty without the consent of the Senate. So we feel really strongly that our U.S. Senate needs to do its job, that our Senate needs to enable us as Americans not only to be able to assist disabled people and governments around the world to learn about the good work that we've been doing, but it's equally important that disabled people have the same opportunities to travel, study, and work abroad as anyone else in our country. And as long as many countries don't have the same laws as we do and don't enforce them if they have them, opportunities for disabled people are more limited. When I travel abroad, I'm always meeting with disabled women. And those women tell me stories about how they experience violence and rape, and how in many cases, these forms of violence occur from family members and people that they know. People that they know, who in fact may be working for them. And frequently, these cases are not adjudicated. I meet disabled people who have been offered jobs by businesses because they live in a country where there's a quota system. And in order to avoid a fine, they will hire you and then tell you, you don't need to come to work because we really don't need you in the facility. I have visited institutions where the stench of urine is so strong that before you open the door of your vehicle, you're kind of pushed back. And then gone into those institutions where people should be living in the community with appropriate supports and seeing people almost naked, people who are chemically drugged, and people who are living lives of despair. These are some of the things that the U.S. needs to be doing more to correct. We know discrimination when we see it, and we need to be fighting it together. So, what is it that we can be doing together? I encourage you all to recognize that disability is a family you can join at any point in your life. I'd like to see by a show of hands, how many of you have ever broken a bone? And then I'd like, when you leave today, to maybe write a couple of sentences about what that period of time has been like for you. Because frequently I hear from people, you know, I couldn't do this, I couldn't do that. People talked to me differently, they acted differently towards me. And that's what I see and other disabled people see in flashing letters. But we, you in this room, people listening and watching this TED Talk, together we can make a difference. Together we can speak up for justice. Together we can help change the world. Thank you. I have to go catch my bus.
This and other episodes of Disability Beat are available at weft.org/public affairs. For updates and information, join our Facebook page at Disability Beat Radio. To share ideas for guests or topics, email Vicki at disabilitybeat@gmail.com. Thanks for tuning in and have a great rest of your week.